Welcome to Family by Design, a weekly radio program brought to you by Wellspring Christian Family Schools, the education ministry of WCF Church, located in Sebillesville, Maryland. We hope that today, in some way, we will help you to treasure God's design for your family.
Because the greatest gift a father can give is a life lived for Jesus. And the greatest gift a mother can give is the knowledge of the Lord. Pass him on to your children. He's the gift that keeps on giving. The greatest gift is a life lived for Jesus.
Good afternoon and welcome to Family by Design, a weekly radio program brought to you by Walkersville Christian Family Schools. Walkersville Christian Family Schools is the education ministry of WCF Church, located in Sebillesville, Maryland. We hope that today, in some way, we will help you to treasure God's design for your family.
Because the greatest gift a father can give is a life lived for Jesus. And the greatest gift a mother can give is the knowledge of the Lord. Pass him on to your children. He's the gift that keeps on giving.
Good afternoon and welcome to Family by Design. I'm Joel Fisher and I am joined again in the studio by pastor and educator Gary Cox. And Gary, it's good to have you back in the studio.
Good to be back.
It's been a little while since we've had the chance to have a more one-on-one conversation. We've been enjoying the previous messages over the last couple months from you and from Becky Wyanda. But today we're ready to have a conversation about something of great significance that's taken place in our country in the last month or so. And these are going to be a somber series of conversations, I think.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
As most of our audience, well, I would imagine probably all of our audience, if they've been paying attention in any way to cultural events, we'll know that at the end of June, on June 26th, the Supreme Court made its ruling or declared its ruling in regards to gay marriage, same-sex marriage, as it is more commonly known, I suppose, basically saying that marriage, same-sex marriage, is a fundamental right, and that basically they, in a sense, shelved or threw away, as you will, the definition of marriage as God had originally and continues to define it from his word and had been upheld by all civilizations essentially everywhere for the last many millennia. So over the course of the next couple conversations, the broadcasts, we want to talk about the relevance of what is happening in our culture to Christians. And Gary, it seems like the appropriate place to start is, have Christians ever found themselves in a situation like this before? Have true believers in God ever found themselves in this kind of situation where the culture has become so absolutely crazy and antagonistic to what is true?
Well, first of all, I would say absolutely, especially when you look at the history of the early church, when it was birthed in the middle of the Roman Empire, which was an absolute authority governing the entire world and using no morality of its own, using a morality of its own, but having no regard for the morality of the God of the Bible.
And even we could go back further. I mean, obviously, as you said, Christianity as the church has been around since the Roman Empire. But we could look back and see other times in history where true believers have basically been very alone and even isolated, if you will, isolated at least in their beliefs, in a pretty hostile culture. And I can't think of anyone better from the Scripture who emulates or gives us an example, maybe even a blueprint, if you will, of the situation that we find ourselves in today than Daniel. Daniel from the Old Testament, who found himself a captive in a pretty pagan society.
Yes, that's a significant point of reference. In fact, I would state that from that time, from the time of the destruction of Jerusalem by Babylon, from that time straight through till this present hour, the construct of human government is such that the scripture calls it Gentile rulers, whereby those who are the true followers of God find themselves underneath, needing to give homage and pay dues and obey the government, governing authorities, without that covering that was known to the Jews prior to that, namely that their government was a theocracy. It was directly being ruled over by the law of God and by God himself in social affairs.
So Daniel went from that sort of environment, at least to some degree, even though arguably when he was taken captive by Babylon, Judah as a nation was not honoring God as they were, but still had a shell at least of that chosen nation, that theocracy that upheld at least in name the laws of God and prided themselves on being God's people. And he was taken to Babylon, and we probably aren't going to delve too much into Babylonian culture, but needless to say, there wasn't a whole lot of genuine honor to a one deity, in a sense.
Right, right.
Or much room for the kind of devotion that the Jews were probably used to.
Right. The Jews were practicing their faith in spite of the culture, not because of the culture.
So I think it's appropriate, as we kind of launch into this sets of discussion, to go back to Daniel's story and see from his example what we can take away as we go forth in this century,
I agree. If I may, I'd like to set a backdrop a little bit. First of all, I have in my hand just a really short summary of four of the points that Justice Kennedy wrote when he made the ruling for the majority, calling the right to marry a fundamental right. Reason one and reason two were basically narrowly focusing on an individual's personal choice, individual autonomy, and the privacy of marriage being between two individuals, two committed individuals. However, it was points three and four that makes the whole ruling so significant to our culture. Point three was marriage safeguards children and families, and number four, marriage is a keystone of our social order. So when you look at those two parts of the ruling, we're pointing to the legal construct of society. So it's important that we understand that as God has ordained government to rule in the affairs of men and to create laws that control the commerce, the interaction, the safety and the well-being of citizens, that government, these Gentile governments from the very beginning, have always been exposed to pagan thought, pagan concerns, pagan issues. And so it's a significant history that has occurred since the only theocracy ever to exist from a scriptural perspective, the kingdom of Israel, kingdom of Judah, since that came to an end at the destruction of Jerusalem. So looking at those two elements, it's important that we understand that the Supreme Court doesn't have the actual ability to define marriage in terms of what marriage is.
Right, true.
What the Supreme Court ruling is about, it's about its right to construct the regulatory system by which rights and privileges and safeguards are put in place to something that they are calling marriage. So for the first time in the history of man, this same-sex marriage is being codified, and it's an important thing to understand. There's an intentionality that the codification is towards safeguarding children and families and making sure that marriage is a keystone of social order in our society. So that's a pretty significant statement from the side of the Supreme Court, but it has actually nothing to do with what marriage is. And so what's important for the believer to think about is, do I live my faith in my culture, or do I allow my culture to define what my faith is? And that's the great battleground that believers always have to find themselves in. When we have a very large amount of sympathy with the culture at large, it's easy for Christians to sort of assume that their culture is primarily a Christian culture. You right. certainly must admit that Western civilization is incredibly colored by what we call the Judeo-Christian ethic and the nature of our laws, etc. But in terms of understanding what's actually taking place before the kingdom of heaven, this world is still under Gentile kings.
Right.
And these Gentile kings have no particular claim on being Christian in any way, shape, or form. Even if we were to attempt to adopt laws that declared America as a Christian nation, that adoption of that language wouldn't make us a Christian nation.
No.
Because what a Christian nation is, in terms of strict scriptural understanding, a Christian nation is when Christ is sitting on the throne as king, and when his saints are the governors and rulers in the entire world. And so that's yet to come, but it's not yet.
Right. And that's very, very important for us to note as we continue on here, because, and actually, I think in a lot of ways, this also helps frame our mindset. Just recently, a friend of mine and I were discussing, he himself is a pastor, and he pointed out that he had just recently heard that, you know, you can look at it from the one's vantage point right now, what's going on in our culture, as if we were losing control. We were losing prominence. If you take the position that, for instance, that we ought to be in power, that Christians in some semblance should be in power, influence, and authority, which to a large degree in this country we have been in the past, instead of viewing us as a influencer, as living in essentially a nation that is not a place where we assume that Christians hold all the keys to power, then you have a different perspective. In a sense, it's a difference of seeing decay as opposed to seeing preservation and influence. And to me, Daniel, and really as you were talking about the people who have been believers throughout Western civilization, that's exactly the impact that they have had in cultures that have been Gentile cultures, pagan cultures, where they have continued to live lives of faithfulness and consistency to God. And thence we come to people like Daniel, people like his friends, people like Esther and Mordecai, who were believers who lived in a state of influencing. They did not seek to have power, as it were, political power, inasmuch as they sought to live faithful lives that would make a difference in the culture that they were in, recognizing that, no, their ambitions were not to establish themselves in seats of power and authority, even though God did give them positions of influence. And I think that's important for us to remember as we approach this discussion, is that this isn't about us regaining some sort of political influence and political power so that we can change that construct, so that we can, you know, make sure we get the political and legal definition of marriage changed, in as much as we as Christians hold fast and true to what God has said is true, so we can have an impact on the culture.
Right. That's one of the most important things about the book of Daniel, is how it carves out some of the significant issues that are still in force today. One of the bywords of the King Nebuchadnezzar himself, after the Lord dealt with him and his pride, King Nebuchadnezzar said, God rules in the affairs of men, and he sets up over men whomsoever he will, even the basest of men. Now, he was referring to himself, and this was after his little escapade of madness, where he was chained outside, and they couldn't keep clothes on him. He grew long hair and claws, and he was a wild beast, and ate grass for a period of 7 years. And then God restored his senses to him, and he finished out his kingdom, and he was giving God the glory and giving God thanks. So it's a sharp snapshot when you look at the role of Christians in the Gentile societies. Daniel's really a good illustration of those roles, and I hope we can get into a lot of these nuances, but let me try to give a little broad overpicture. Number one, there's a sense of powerlessness in that the government system is bigger than you are, and it has the capability and the power to even oppress you substantially. And as you go through the book of Daniel,
That's where we start, as a slave coming into
right.
into Babylon.
And so what we find is, and of course, my firstborn son I named Daniel because as a new Christian, I was studying the book of Daniel and coming to grips with what it meant to be a Christian in the world I lived in. And it was my goal, my objective, to dare to be a Daniel. And the key about daring to be a Daniel was that we are slaves, we are servants. If I enter into this culture that we're a part of, it's not as a ruler, it's as a servant. Now, that parallels Jesus' teaching so well. He said, now, listen, the Gentiles, they have this rule of model that the guy on top is the big cookie, and everybody below him, you know, has to give him obeyance and what have you. But that's not the way it is in my kingdom. What's happened is the big guy, the guy, the big cookie, he's the servant of everybody. So he upends it. So there's this incredible reverse role that Christians have as servants. So literally, Daniel and his friends were being trained to be servants at the king's wish. But what they sought to do was, in the construct of the culture they were going to be servants in, they retained personal integrity of the utmost purity of heart. And my favorite line in the opening chapter of Daniel was, here's these slaves are imported with all these other people from every other nation, and they're being given the king's regimen for education, which included food and what type of food and, you know, how it was fixed, etc. Well, the food that they were to be given was a violation of the personal, moral sense of well-being that these Jews brought with them from their religious background. So it was food that, spiritually speaking, to those Jews would defile themselves.
It was anathema.
So it was something so contradictory to their religious values. And that opening chapter is so marvelous because these guys wrestle with the fact, we're slaves. We don't have any rights. I mean, the king's training us up, and when he's finished, he can promote us and give us a high position, or he can destroy us and cut us off. I mean, we're just slaves. So in this context, there was something unique. And this is the mark of a believer, and this is what we don't ever want to lose as Christians in our culture today. The mark of the believer is the fragrance of God's blessing on our lives. There's something about the very presence of God that's attractive, that's recognizable, that stands out in the crowd. So these guys already had a humble attitude. And I think we need to understand, the humility of servanthood makes me somebody different in attitude. And when I have an attitude of humility, I'm easier to be entreated, especially if somebody's over me. When I'm someone in charge and I've got people under me who are voluntarily, enthusiastically doing everything they can to comply with my governance, I like them. I want them to be a part of my team. So these guys had already gained favor by their humility, by their servant's heart. And so having that favor, when they saw they've got this diet they've got to control, they went in humility and they made a personal request, a personal appeal. And I want us to understand, there was nothing legal in it. They had nothing to fall back on legally.
Yeah,
they couldn't charge the guy and say, listen, if you don't feed us what we're supposed to feed, we're suing you.
Right.
And we're going to take you to court, and we're going to have you lose your job.
And just maybe as a caveat there, we're going to get into a little bit later the fact that in this country we still do have some of those recourses. But the bottom line is their whole attitude and approach was one of servanthood and desiring to be a blessing.
And I think we as Christians need to understand that when we have sincerely held religious beliefs, so that we're walking in humility towards God and not in arrogance towards ourselves or to our society, we stand out. And we put ourselves in a situation that, as we stand out, people kind of wonder, what are you thinking? What are you doing?
And
the greatest privilege
a
Christian could ever have is in the cultural setting they're in, that the mere practice of their sincerely held religious beliefs is done in such a fashion that it draws attention and people want to know, what are you doing? And it you might get persecuted for it. You know, 1 Peter 3 says, be ready to give an answer to anyone, ask the reason for the hope that lies within you. Why are you doing these crazy things? But give your answer with meekness and fear, because you're a spokesman for the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Now, they might think it's strange, that you don't run with them to the same excess of their riotous living. But still, you're making an impact. And it's important for us believers to know that we have to have a sense of freedom, of confidence, and of humility, so that we're serving God, we're not snubbing our neighbor. And it's important that we understand that, because often what happens in cultural exchanges when we get into issues like this, it can look like, or at least it can be easily portrayed, and maybe we can easily fall into it, that we're merely attacking something that we call evil. And so we just come across in this attack mode. But the significant reality is we have an obligation first to our own conscience to live it and to express it and to give an answer for it. And Christians walking in that fashion have the opportunity very, very often to gain for themselves exceptions, like Daniel and his friends did, even if they were experimental exceptions, so that they can follow their conscience in a culture that otherwise is not permitted. And that's really significant, because
it is.
That's impacting
it is.
Heaven.
Right.
We're touching lives for eternity when we have that kind of contact. We need to understand that's our privilege.
Right.
If we have Christ and we're in community and in a culture, it's our privilege to bump up against other people and to spill out the fragrance of Christ in those circumstances.
I love what you said about how Daniel and those who were his associates, and we know of three others like Daniel. Maybe there were more. I don't know. We know those particular four. But you see both sides of the coin throughout the book of Daniel. You see Daniel becoming very influential. You see Daniel being very well loved by these Gentile rulers who haven't a clue in the world about his Jewish weird religion, but they sure love Daniel, and they sure love his friendship.
Well, here's the remarkable thing about the book of Daniel and these guys, and this is why it's so attractive to me personally. When you have personal influence, all of a sudden, you're desirable. And so it's like the servant Christian can have more impact on policies and practice in government just by being desirable. And when you look at the spread, I mean, Shadrach and his friends, Daniel and his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they became the top presidents, the top appointees in Babylon.
Right.
Daniel, I mean, I love this snapshot. The history of Babylon was such that it went through two kings and a third king with another empire. And he held prominence in all kings. In other words, his influence wasn't affected by a political party he belonged to. It didn't even affect a national structure. He was able to be influential,
right,
by his character being something that was desirable and sought after. And,
right.
And that is so cool.
It is cool.
As believers, that we can function that way, where we have a government official look at us and say, okay, we've got a problem. Can you help me solve this problem? And all of a sudden, we have that capacity to help work through.
Right.
So that is.
And at the same time, we're not at all conveying here, and you don't come away from the book of Daniel saying, oh, well, okay, as long as you have the servant attitude and you're humble and you do really well at that, you're not going to have any persecution and you're not going to have any trouble and you're never going to have to face problems.
I mean, no, you might end up in the fiery furnace and you might end up
right,
in the lion's den.
And that's what's so cool about the story of Daniel, is that here we see a man who lived out a life that he encountered both those scenarios. He did suffer persecution, but he also impacted, the nations in which he was prominent, and really his own nation ultimately in the end. We are getting close here to the end of our time, and we're going to continue this conversation soon. I would encourage you, if you're listening to this broadcast, that you spend some time as you follow along with us in these conversations by reading the book of Daniel and seeing for yourself the record of a man who lived in a time not unlike the time that we're facing ourselves, and become familiar with how God used him and how he reacted to the things that were going on in his life. You can hear this message at WTHU.org. Go to the Audio Vault and look for Family by Design. You will find this recording along with the other broadcasts that we've aired since the beginning of this radio program. If you have questions or like to comment on things that you've been hearing on the radio on this program, you can write to radio@wcfs.edu. We would love to hear from you. Until next time, I'm Joel Fisher, hoping that you'll join us again right here on Family by Design as we continue to treasure God's design for your family.
Children houses, and you can give them lands, and the riches of your efforts, and all your best laid plans.
But of all that they inherit, of all that you could will, please include the unseen treasure of a life that God has filled. Cause the greatest gift a father can give is a life lived for Jesus. And the greatest gift a mother can give is the knowledge of the Lord. Pass him on to your children.
Your children.
He's the gift that keeps on giving. The greatest gift is a life lived for Jesus.
Someday the house will crumble. Time will turn the land to dust. And when all accounts are empty, where will you invest their trust?
But if the riches that you give him is the wisdom of his ways, then the wealth you'll leave your children will last through all their days. Cause the greatest gift a father can give is a life lived for Jesus. And the greatest gift a mother can give is the knowledge of the Lord. Pass him on to your children. He's the gift that keeps on giving. The greatest gift is a life lived for Jesus. Is a life lived for Jesus. And the greatest gift a mother can give is the knowledge of the Lord. Pass him on to your children. He's the gift that keeps on giving. The greatest gift is a life lived for Jesus.
Thanks for spending your time with us today here at Family by Design. Join us every Sunday when we will continue this wonderful journey, helping you to treasure God's design for your family.
Cause the greatest gift a father can give is a life lived for Jesus. And the greatest gift a mother can give is the knowledge of the Lord. Pass him on to your children.
Your children.
He's the gift that keeps on giving. The greatest gift is a life lived for Jesus.